welcome. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Last month, a congressional committee acknowledged for the first time what many teachers have known for a long time, that terrible working conditions are not only impacting part-time instructors, but their students as well. The report found the vast majority of teachers who responded felt that they were missing opportunities to better serve their students because of the demands on their schedule. Colleges and universities increasingly rely on part-time faculty rather than on full-time tenure-track professors to meet instructional demands while trying to contain costs. These part-time positions are among the fastest growing on campus. More than 1 million people are now working as contingent faculty and instructors at U.S. institutions of higher education, providing a cheap labor source even while student tuitions have skyrocketed. These part-time professors, called the low-wage workers of academia, now make up half of college faculty. They're paid an average of about $3,000 per class, making an average of $25,000 a year. In contrast, the median pay for a full-time faculty member is nearly double, about $48,000. In order to earn comparable wages, one would have to teach 15 to 17 courses per year, but researchers consider a full course load for an academic year to be 8 courses at most. Part-time non-tenure-track teachers, also known as adjunct, can spend years juggling multiple courses, sometimes with additional non-academic jobs squeezed in between in order to make ends meet. Many have no job stability or benefits like health insurance. But more and more teachers are organizing for greater public awareness and for change. The SEIU is moving to add adjuncts to their union rosters, organizing at private and public universities. So what happens for students when their teachers are contractors, not full-time professors? And how are teachers trying to create better working conditions and learning environments? Well, to discuss all this along with you, we're joined by Dr. Adriana Kizar, who's a professor of higher education at the University of Southern California, and she's the director of the Delphi Project. That project works with multiple representatives and organizations to develop an understanding of the nature of the professoriate today and to develop strategies for improvement. Dr. Kizar is a national expert of change and leadership in higher education. Hi, Adriana.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. And we're also joined by Maria Maisto, who's an adjunct English teacher at Cuyahoga Community College in Cleveland and president of the New Faculty Majority. That's a group organizing to create equitable, non-exploitative academic environments that promote more effective teaching, learning, and research. Hi, Maria.
Hi, nice to be here.
Thank you for joining us. We're also joined in studio by Christian Nagler, who's an adjunct writing and arts teacher at the San Francisco Art Institute. He's recently joined the SEIU's Adjunct Action to campaign for better conditions. Hi, Christian. Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure.
All right, so we've got a lot to wade through. I want to start with you, Adriana. The practice of hiring adjuncts seems to have begun in the 70s at community colleges, but at that time they only made up a small percentage of teachers. I think what I read was that between 75 and 80% of all college and university faculty were full-time tenure-track professors. Now the part-time faculty has grown by more than 300%, and half of all teachers in higher education are adjuncts. So can you just give us a sense of what explains this explosive growth and why academia has evolved in this particular way?
Sure. And as you mentioned, early on, adjuncts were meant to be someone who brought in external expertise in a particular field. In community colleges, it might be somebody who was a journalist who worked in technical fields like automotive, and they were a small part of the labor force and brought in, you know, usually to teach, you know, one or two classes. So they had had other full-time jobs, and it was a particular purpose and role for the adjuncts. And over time, again, the claims by institutions are that they didn't have the finances to continue to hire full-time faculty. Yet we know, there was a recent report that just came out last week, that campuses have increased their costs, and it's mostly going to staffing. So it's really an issue of priorities and where the money's going. And we do have money to pay for full-time faculty, but institutions followed corporations in the 80s and 90s that were moving to largely contingent and part-time labor.
And you've also found that during this time, the growth in the administrative staff has grown a lot.
Correct.
During the time that adjuncts are growing and full-time tenure-track professors are shrinking.
Exactly.
So what's the effect of that kind of shift?
So the effect of hiring more staffing is, you know, if there's going to be, there's less funding to distribute to other areas like instruction. So that has been, you know, there are several national studies that track the where money is spent in higher education, and so we clearly know that it's not going to instruction and it is going to staffing. So that is a problematic trend that the public policy, policymakers and the general public should be concerned about.
And I want to, we've already got some emails from adjunct faculty. I want to put a particular call out to adjunct faculty, to students who are aware of this issue, or maybe you don't even notice it. It'd be interesting to hear. And administrators, if you are an administrator on a college campus, we've got a lot of them around here in the Bay Area in Northern California. What is your perspective on all of this? What is the role of an administrator? And if you've made the decision to hire more administrators instead of faculty, what goes into making that decision? Our number is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. People are also sending us emails to feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you want to remain anonymous, that's fine. Again, our number is 866-798-8255. Talk. And let me go to Maria. One of the things that's interesting to me as somebody who has been an adjunct, I did it for 20 years ago, 25 years ago, and for at least a decade, I noticed that suddenly there's a lot of media attention on this. What do you think explains this recent media attention, this recent push? Why now to organize, I guess, is the question.
Well, I think that part of the reason is that adjuncts have been organizing in greater numbers and in more consistent ways. Certainly, I think the existence of groups like us, we are actually the only national group that focuses exclusively on contingent faculty issues, but certainly the unionizing effort that has taken off and the stepped-up efforts of the traditional faculty unions to look at the effect of contingent faculty working conditions on student learning has certainly played a part. I also think students have helped bring attention to this issue because as attention to the cost of college has gone up, people are becoming more concerned about, well, what is, you know, where is all that money going and how is this affecting students directly on campuses?
And let's hear a little bit about the reality of this kind of adjunct juggle that teachers are doing. Christian, you now have a single position teaching writing and art at San Francisco Art Institute, but you used to work at multiple campuses. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a sense of your own experience, the pros and cons, why you went into this, and how your job has kind of changed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I want to say the position that I have right now is a pretty good one for adjuncts. I don't have to go shuttling around to multiple institutions. I did that for about 10 years, and I found that it was really, really difficult to put in the sort of, to really focus on the students and to focus on my job. So other things that distract from that are that course loads can change really unpredictably. There's no guarantee.
And you have a semester-to-semester contract, right?
Yeah, semester-to-semester
contract. But part of that contract is if you don't have enrollment or if they need to change something, they can just drop the course.
They can cut classes or add them at the last minute. So oftentimes adjuncts are teaching something that they were called in, you know, maybe a day before to teach. Oftentimes I've had to take over in the middle of the semester for adjuncts who simply can't go on teaching at their wage.
They just feel like they're juggling too much and not making enough. They need to take a waitressing job or
exactly,
whatever.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Anything that will pay their bills.
And you said that you've had colleagues, adjunct colleagues, who had to go on food stamps, who were even homeless, did you say?
Yeah. I've known other professors, other instructors who have been unable to pay their rent in the middle of the semester, had to live with friends and family. I think that's a big thing that happens in adjuncting is that you rely on your community, on your family, on a lot of different freelancing jobs. Mm-hmm. That's how I am able to make ends meet at this point.
And now your situation is much better. You're only at one institution. You get paid a better wage than the average $3,000 per course, but it's still not much more than that.
No, it's still a sub-living wage, although, you know, there are benefits. I feel like I just feel good about myself being able to do my job, really.
But you face a reduced teaching load because of the Affordable Care Act?
That's one reason that the administration says is, I think, the Affordable Care Act. But also, I think the more public reason that they give is that they want to keep kind of fresh blood moving through the institution, which I think for a lot of the core curriculum is a big problem. The more experience I think a teacher has at a particular institution, really the better they can teach their subject, the better they know that institution's population of students, the better that they can, you know, focus on those students and their particular challenges. And
I want to get to some callers and I want to read some emails, but let me ask each of you just a little bit about what you think makes for a good learning environment in terms of trying to put this into the context. Obviously, we care about working conditions of the people teaching, but there's a lot of people who have difficult working conditions. How do you think that this affects the learning environment? And can we talk a little bit about what changes would make for a much better, rich learning environment? Why don't we start with you, Adriana?
Sure. I think the big issue is preparation. When you're generally hired last minute, sometimes during the first week of classes, you don't have the time to properly prepare, and that is a very routine practice of institutions. Last minute hiring, semester to semester hiring, and if you don't know, if you have a sense that you're teaching something, you can obviously be preparing for it ahead of time. Get the text. Often adjuncts get the textbook, as they're teaching the class. So they're reading the material at the same time as the students, and that's really unfair. The kinds of ways that we're impacting their ability to perform, we as institutions are not allowing them, as we've heard, to do the best job that they can. And it's really our practices that make that happen. The other really significant issue is there's so much research data we know that faculty and students interacting is one of the most significant impacts on students' development during college. This is both traditional age students as well as older students. When adjuncts are teaching between multiple institutions and commuting and have to run directly after class, the time that students take, and sometimes it can be just asking a single question, but those interactions, whether it be to ask a question after class, to be able to talk to somebody in office hours, to be available via email, are really, really important.
And it's
student retention and knowing that somebody's caring about their learning.
Yeah, and it's really interesting that you bring that up, because what I've seen is that more and more students are really stressed out and having to juggle multiple jobs in order to pay this high cost of education and all of that. So at the same time, you've got the teachers that are not there and that are stressed out. You've got students who are more and more experiencing that same phenomenon. Christian, you're nodding here. What do you think is important for administrators and the public to take into consideration in terms of what makes a good learning environment?
Mm-hmm. I think for the faculty to be, really for the administrators to recognize how much preparation time it takes to teach a student, as well as what Adriana said, the more contact, the more one-on-one contact with students, particularly for the core curriculums, like the writing, like I teach, it takes a lot of one-on-one attention to really, particularly with the difficulties in that high school teachers are having kind of teaching students to write, basically. We have a lot of catch-up work to do, and it's, I think to return to one of Adriana's earlier points, I think that a lot of the higher level administration, they don't really seem to understand as well what happens in the classroom. A lot of them, I think, are hired for, as she said, their kind of corporate managerial fundraising and marketing experience.
Although a lot of administrators are former faculty, too.
It's true. It's true. Definitely. Yeah. I think just to...
But increasingly less so, that's been the trend. I mean, it used to be that administrators came out of the faculty, and that trend is changing.
Mm-hmm. Got it. I'm sorry, Christian, you were finished, please.
And I think the trend supports them seeing students more as customers, faculty as kind of operating costs to be cut down, rather than to kind of try to, you know, optimize the contact that faculty and students are having.
So let's dig into that just a little bit more, the idea of seeing students as customers. I mean, there is a good piece of that, which is that they're here, you know, they're paying for an education. It's really mm-hmm. important that they get that promise fulfilled. I think, Adriana, you brought up the idea that, you know, originally adjunct faculty were there to be people who should have their one foot in the business world, mm-hmm. the journalistic field, they're yep. practitioners, and so they bring this special expertise. How do you weigh the sort of benefits of that and this idea that, you know, students, there is a promise that you're making to students, and you should be really attentive to that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just that the numbers have completely gotten out of whack, right? I mean, and the numbers even higher than you said. It's 50% part-time, but there's another 20% of contingent labor that are on year-to-year contracts rather than semester-to-semester. So we're actually up to 70% contingent labor. So it's, you know, an even higher number. And what we're seeing because of that is what was once, you know, individuals who contributed some expertise in a particular class. So it's mostly in, you know, if for a four-year institution, it's their upper division class, and a community college, it's in their area of specialization. So, you know, when you had just small numbers of faculty doing that and a large body of full-time faculty who understood the program and the curriculum and the learning goals and were there for the students, it worked. But we flip-flop that to the degree that now faculty are not there. Faculty are mm-hmm. not developing the programs and curriculum and connected, and we're devolving the whole learning experience.
And Maria, how are tenured faculty responding to these organizing drives? Are they responsive? Are they supportive? Or are they agnostic? What's the kind of response?
You know, I think it really varies. A lot of it depends on the culture of a particular institution or a region. I certainly think that there is an increasing amount of support from the tenured faculty toward organizing efforts by the non-tenured faculty, but certainly not enough. That there needs to be more, and I think the more that faculty realize that we really are one faculty working for all students, as the title of a recent Coalition on the Academic Workforce report put it, the better it will be for students and for the institutions of higher education as a whole. So there's, you know, we continue to work to help tenured faculty be more supportive and to help non-tenured faculty organize more effectively.
And I want to get to, we have a lot of callers on the line. I want to get to as many as possible because I think a lot of people have a lot of questions and comments about this. Morgan writes in and says, I'm sorry I can't be on today's show or I can't listen to today's show. I've been teaching filmmaking for years but wanted to teach at the university level, and that required an MFA. So I went back to school for 3 years, graduating in 2001. I haven't been able to get full-time work since. One community college program director where I was teaching said the school will never give me more than 8 hours because then they would need to give me benefits. I have a lot of student loan debt. I feel I've been duped. I consistently get good feedback and reviews, but I can't make a living wage. This system is broken. What are our priorities? Does anybody want to respond to Morgan? I mean, I wonder about the sort of PhD factory, the higher education degree factory, and this idea of people feeling duped. Mm-hmm. Christian, you're nodding again.
Yeah, I think it's a big problem for faculty. I mean, making a sub-living wage and having to pay back huge student loans. I mean, right. It puts, you know, the students and the faculty in a very similar position in that way, which I think is good for the solidarity between them sometimes. But, you know, I knew a faculty at a place that I worked before, which was a for-profit institution. He was teaching 13 classes a semester.
13 in one semester?
13 in one semester, and which added up to be 39 hours in class each week.
That's
which
just
was
class hours.
Just below the 40-hour limit to be full-time, so he had no benefits. And it was a lot because he was paying back student loans. I don't know how he did it, actually.
So I hear Maria or Adriana, this idea of being duped.
Maria. Yeah, I wanted to say, too, that it's not only that. I mean, it's that as a society, we're paying the price for this, because education is a public good, and when we don't invest in public in education, then all of society suffers in various ways, not only in terms of the effects on student learning, but also in terms of the effects on the public system, where we have more and more faculty who are defaulting on student loans, who are on public assistance, who don't have any retirement, so that then the system and individual families end up subsidizing what higher education is not taking responsibility for. So it's not just faculty being duped, really. It's all of us being duped. We're not fulfilling the promise of higher education as a public good.
And is a lot of this due to the divestment of public funds in higher education and in public education in particular?
I think so, and I know Adriana can say more about that, but certainly one of the ways that students, faculty, and administrators can come together is to help make that message more clear to our leaders, to our policymakers, that we need to reinvest in education.
And in the meantime, though, there's other things that we can do. Adriana, do you want to talk to that idea of public investment? We have about 2 minutes before we go to a break.
Sure. No, I want to talk about public investment, but I also want to talk about higher education's complicitness in this problem. We produce a lot of PhDs. We like to have teaching assistants. You know, while people are in graduate school, they're also captive cheap labor for the institutions. It serves higher education well to produce a lot more than are needed for the market in terms of PhDs and masters, and to have them teaching, and degrees are being drawn out longer and longer, so people are teaching assistants for longer within the institutions, which is a cheap form of labor. So we're very complicit in creating an oversupply. But there has been a strong public disinvestment in the past 20 years from higher education, which did put pressures on higher education institutions. Their real dollars have gone down in the last 20 years. And the money is increasingly not being put towards instruction, being put towards administration. So we have the public giving less money to education, which creates problematic pressures. And then the institution itself is making the wrong decision in not investing in instruction with the money it has left.
You've got about 30 seconds.
Yeah, I want to say that the money's going, I think, towards administration as well as marketing and recruitment,
yeah,
which I think really goes to the point of, treating the students responsibly as customers, I think, is one thing. Treating them as customers to be gouged is another thing.
And beware of these false promises, potentially. That's Christian Nagler. He's an adjunct writing and arts teacher at San Francisco Arts Institute. We're also joined by Maria Maisto, who's an adjunct English teacher at Cuyahoga Community College in Cleveland, and she's president of the New Faculty Majority. And Dr. Adriana Kizar is a professor of higher education at the University of Southern California and director of the Delphi Project. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about what some people are calling a crisis in higher education today, which is the explosive growth of part-time and adjunct teachers at colleges and universities. They now make up half or more than half, 50 to 70% of teaching faculty in higher education, and they're being called the working poor of academia. Many have no benefits, they have large workloads, no job security. So we're asking, what is the effect on the education that students are getting? And we will focus on what is the solution to have more effective and fair working conditions for those responsible for educating the next generation of college grads. I'm Holly Kernan. This is Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
There are so many ways you can take part in today's conversation on Your Call. On the phone, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. or by going to the yourcallradio.org website and just leaving a message. Coming up in 30 minutes at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. Today they'll be discussing how much support protesters in the Ukraine have. That's the BBC's World Have Your Say. Coming up at 11 here on KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, Rose is going to talk with Elizabeth Colbert about her new book, The Sixth Extinction. The book shows how humanity is altering life on the planet, and as a result, numerous species are disappearing before our eyes. Friday, of course, is our weekly media roundtable. We speak with journalists about the week's news. Today, we're talking about working conditions for adjunct teachers at public higher education institutions, both public and private. They frequently work for low pay. Often, they receive no benefits. And so we're asking, how are higher education teachers making a living? What impact is that having on students? And how are they now organizing for change? I'll give out the number in a minute because we have full lines, but you can also send us emails to feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you are a teacher, let us know what your experience is, what you think could or should change. If you're an administrator, tell us about the quandaries that you face and how you view this. Again, it's feedback@yourcallradio.org. And our guests are Christian Nagler, who's an adjunct writing and arts teacher at the San Francisco Art Institute. He recently joined the SEIU's Adjunct Action to Campaign for Better Conditions. We're also joined by Dr. Adriana Kizar, who's a professor of higher education at the University of Southern California, and Maria Maisto, who's an adjunct English teacher at Cuyahoga Community College in Cleveland and president of the New Faculty Majority, which is organizing to create equitable, non-exploitative academic environments. And let's go straight to so many calls. Let's go first to Cliff in Berkeley. Hi, Cliff. Thanks for being patient with us.
Hi, and thanks for taking the call. Can you hear me? I'm on a hands-free.
Yes, you have a good hands-free okay. So far.
Okay, great. So I'm coming at this from the customer perspective, if you will. I'm the parent of a college-bound high school senior, and I have, I guess this is a three-part question, but I'll make it concise. I wonder whether in looking for a quality education for my daughter, one of the things I should be looking for are schools that use either a lower proportion of adjuncts or that have more optimal policies about their adjuncts. So that's part. That's the first question. The second question is whether you can even find that out. And then the third question, or third part of the question, is whether maybe some of the pressure for improving the situation has to come or could come from consumers who demand either higher proportions of tenured faculty or full-time faculty or better policies and conditions for the adjuncts.
Great. Well, go ahead and stay on the line, Cliff, if you like, and let's get Adriana and Maria to answer those questions. So the first one is, what should you be looking for as a parent, a consumer, a student, in terms of the quality of an education that you're getting? What are the kind of optimal policies on adjunct, on faculty in general?
Cliff, I think that's a great question. This is Adriana. I do think there's a role for parents in terms of asking the question. The American Federation of Teachers, in fact, put out a guidebook for parents with questions like this about asking the institution how many full-time instructors are there. And it asks about the time that the student will have in terms of office hours and time with faculty. So I there is already one resource to help parents in thinking this through when they visit colleges. The information is not readily available to parents, and I do think that it is one of the issues that some think tanks in D.C. have suggested would be a way to have higher education institutions rethink their practices if it was more public and parents and customers were asking about this. Your question about would I be able to find out if the institution has a high proportion of adjunct faculty, you would have to probably do a lot of sleuthing and asking. It would not be readily available information at most institutions. But certainly a parent and a student is much better served. We have plenty of data that suggests the negative impact when you have large numbers of adjuncts, so you want to look for institutions that have, higher proportions of full-time faculty and have more optimal you know, policies for the adjuncts that they have.
And then Cliff's third question was, if, you know, should this pressure come from the consumers demanding reform? I guess another way to frame that is, if you have allies that are parents and students, what kinds of demands should they be making?
Right. Yeah, this is Maria. I think that that's absolutely critical. In fact, one of the reasons I got involved in this work is because I have three kids who are going to be college age soon. And this is a huge concern to me. So students and parents have to realize the power that they have when they go on those college tours, when they contact colleges. They should ask those questions very pointedly. There is another resource on the Modern Language Association website, mla.org. There is a database where you can look up the percentages of full-time and part-time faculty for any institution in the country, and you can see how it's changed over a couple of decades. So that there is that resource. But Adriana's right, there is not enough information available, and we think that it should be a requirement that schools disclose what the percentage of part-time contingent and full-time faculty is at an institution, and what those working conditions are. What are they being paid? Do they have offices? How much support are they getting?
That seems like important point, because this is much more nuanced than who is an adjunct faculty. Just to play devil's advocate, I am an adjunct faculty, and I think I do a really great job. Now, I have good working conditions, but what I think makes me a better teacher is the fact that I'm a practitioner. So I don't know that just looking at the pure numbers are going to...
Yeah, I think that, you know, we have to remember that people who are teaching at this level get training, and academic training is not somehow worse than practical experience. We have to be careful not to devalue the kind of training that academics get. Certainly, many practitioners talk about the need for better support in terms of their teaching, and so professional development as a whole is something that also should be looked at when teachers, whether they are come from an academic background or from a quote unquote real world background, don't get the support they need to improve their teaching, then everybody suffers.
And let's go to more calls. We have so many people on the line. Let's go to Larry in Berkeley. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Holly. Thank you for doing this program. There's a huge elephant in the room that you haven't spotted yet, all of you, and that is online education. I've been an adjunct faculty for, this is my 22nd year, and we were all laid off where I teach, Cal State East Bay, in the budget crisis about 4 or 5 years ago, and we were told, some of us, that we would be rehired, which some of us, like me, were. However, as we were being rehired, we found out that more and more emphasis was being placed on teaching online. If we wanted to pick up courses, we were told we could pick up these classes teaching online, which is a horrible way, as far as I'm concerned, to teach. You never get to meet your students. They never interact with each other in a meaningful manner. How on earth are you supposed to write a letter of recommendation or job reference for somebody you've never met? It's all crazy, and the pressure is on us because, although I insist that I'll only teach classes online that have the usual number of students, which is already pretty large, 45.
That is large.
I have a friend who teaches at a different state college. He has 2,000 students this semester in his course, all over the state and indeed all over the world. He gets paid exactly the same as he would if he had 30 or 40 students. And the more pressure that comes from people like Governor Brown, for example, increase the use of technology, the more we're going to see us being squeezed into what is, as far as I'm concerned, is a counterproductive educational model, which is cost-efficient for the institutions and terrible for the students.
Well, thank you for that, Larry. I don't want to completely derail this discussion. We will take that up as another follow-up to this conversation. But, Christian, you seem to want to be getting in on this whole idea of online education being the elephant in the room.
Yeah, just a few points about that. They've done a few studies that have found that that online education is actually not more cost-effective. That's one point. Another point is that the completion rate for online courses is really, really low.
Yeah, in fact, they did one of those studies right here in Northern California at San Jose State, right?
So again, it's just another way in which students are not being served by the current
trends.
And
should that be something that we're putting at the forefront of this discussion, is the service to students?
I think that's a really, really important part of it, definitely. I mean, I think that I mean, the labor issues for faculty are also really important, and I'm invested in that. But I think as a really committed career teacher, the thing that really saddens me the most is that I feel like education is going down.
And what keeps you committed? I mean, it seems really hard to stay committed under these conditions.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a combination of factors. I mean, I think it's a hope that things will get better. And now that there's more energy around organizing, I feel a lot of hope, actually. I mean, I think it'll be a slow progress, but I think that this is the first step in things getting better, really, is the faculty and the students organizing to send some messages to the administration. I think, to go back to Cliff, the caller's point, I think it's really, really crucial that parents of high school students, the high school students themselves, do a lot of good sleuthing and research to get behind the public faces of some of these institutions and to really talk to teachers. I think that, you know, it'll take a little bit of research, but I think that they could, with a few conversations, get a pretty good sense of the level of education happening at an institution.
Great. And Larry, we'll bring up at our next editorial meeting, delving into this question of MOOCs and online education, the pros and cons. Let's go to Anonymous in Oakland. Hi, Anonymous. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for accepting my call. I'm an adjunct at the Peralta Community College District in Oakland. I wanted to respond briefly to the first caller and ask a question also briefly. As an adjunct, I think one of the adverse effects for the students is that depending on your course load, at least in my district, teachers don't have paid office hours and often can't afford to go in on their own time to do office hours, even for large classes. And perhaps as a result more of the overall funding situation for our district, teachers often have overcrowded classrooms. I have an overcrowded classroom this semester in spite of asking for, you know, a changed classroom with more seating for the students, and the situation still hasn't been resolved. And then my personal question is, I was hired last semester to teach two courses. I have a PhD in my field. And this semester, two additional teachers were hired to teach the same class, and so there's three of us now teaching one course, and currently I wasn't rehired for the summer or the fall semester. I'm not sure why. It's not that I want to put anybody else out of a job or reduce opportunities for other teachers, but I was wondering if I have any sort of recourse or a basis for a complaint, and if not, if there's something that I can do to protect myself against this sort of situation.
Well, so Anonymous, I want to let you know that we can't give you legal advice here. That might be something that you need to consult with a lawyer. But what advice do you have for adjuncts facing, you know, similar conditions to what we're talking about right here, Maria or Adriana?
Well, they certainly should find out, you know, if I didn't hear her institution, but if there's a union, definitely need to get in touch with their union. And certainly if there isn't one, find out if there's a grievance process at their institution. But this is why organizing is so important, because it's only through collective action, really, that we can address those kinds of structural problems, because they are usually primarily, they're not personal, although sometimes they can be, as we know, but we have to address them through an organized mechanism through which you can affect change.
Anybody else want to add anything for her? Another question that she sort of brings up is that, you know, non-faculty doesn't have a voice in academic senates and in governance.
Yeah, I think institutions often, this is Adriana, don't have a sense, we were talking earlier about it, of what goes on in the classroom, they don't recognize the how their choices are impacting the learning experience. So not paying for office hours, as the caller's talking about, is really significant, yet I don't sense the administration that made the decision probably knows that, or that somebody like the caller who's been teaching the class and really got it down and then switching it over to other faculty, you know, the impact that all of these decisions have on the students and the learning environment, I think the administration's just gotten too distant to realize this, and it's, you know, a real example of the problem.
and you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Cronin, and we're talking about the growing ranks of adjunct faculty at higher education institutions, and that the effect that that's having on the education that students are receiving and the working conditions that adjunct professors are working under. And if you want to join our conversation, the number is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. If you are a part-time teacher at a local college, let us know what your working conditions are like. And are you joining the movement to organize? What can we do to solve some of these problems, make sure that there are fair working conditions for professors, and to make sure that students are getting the education that they expect to be getting? Let's go to GS in Richmond. Hi, GS. Welcome to your call.
Hello, Holly. Hello, guests. I have a radical proposal, but basically first, nobody who works honestly, approximately 40 hours a week should be deprived of the benefits that they really ought to be given. But that's just a presage, I guess, if that's a word, to my real proposal. My radical proposal is simply that this country recognize that without uplifting the citizenry through good education and such, we're just going to all go downhill. So the proposal is this. Let's convince the people in power in the federal government to spend as much money on at least higher education and maybe K through 12 plus higher education as they spend on the U.S. military.
All right. Well, thank you for that radical proposal. That's from GS in Richmond. Let's. Karen writes in and she says, I have a PhD from Harvard and a postdoc from UCSF, and I was on the research faculty at UCSF for 12 years, all on soft money. One year, when none of the five grant proposals I had written got funded, the chair of my department told me I had to leave. No funding, no job. Well, I was then asked to teach a medical sociology class at Berkeley. The class of 100 students would be meeting three times a week. I would not have a teaching assistant, parking privileges, the compensation would have been $1,000 less than what a first year teaching assistant would have gotten. My friends never understood why I, an academic with years of experience in publications, didn't take a dead end job. So let's get a little bit past some of these depressing stories. I've got more that I'm going to read there in front of me. But can we focus a little bit on some of the solutions, on the organizing that you're doing, Maria and Christian?
Adriana. Well,
yeah.
The last email that you read connects to the caller's comment, I think, about the effects of the unstable contract semester to semester. And there, unfortunately, in my experience, there is very little recourse to filing grievances, to not being hired back. And part of that is the administrators not knowing the effect, as I think Adriana commented. But also, I think the unstable contract is a leverage point for the administrators to get, you know, extra uncompensated work out of the adjuncts in hopes that they will get their classes the next semester. And so I think really, really it's long-term strategies of organization at this point.
Long-term strategies for organization. Adriana and Maria, anything to add to that? And I want to go to more callers soon.
Well, organization is absolutely key. And a lot of people think that if you can't organize in the context of a union, then you can't organize. And that's not the case at all. I live in Ohio where there are significant obstacles to part-time faculty organizing, and yet we're doing it anyway. So I think, you know, joining with the national movements that are taking place both within union contexts and outside of union contexts are important, because when you organize, you can begin to have a more unified voice. That's certainly been part of the effect of our ability to get Congress's attention. And connecting with the important research that connects faculty working conditions to student learning conditions, as Adriana has done, I think is critical.
And Catherine in Berkeley, she writes from UC Berkeley, I was a temporary, in quotes, lecturer at UC Berkeley for over 30 years. I recently retired. I just wanted to say that in my experience, the quality of instruction has not suffered because the standards for hiring adjuncts are so high. However, given the fact that most of these hires have advanced degrees or equivalent practical experience, the pay is well below standard and the working conditions are abysmal. Some of the most creative and inspiring teachers at UC are lecturers, but they burn out a lot faster than faculty who have institutional support support and respect. Can you talk a little bit about this? Oh, she says, she goes on to say, this is where students suffer in the fact that it's hard to develop intellectual relationships with faculty over the years. They're at a college or university, and the fact that adjunct teaching loads are such that student contact time is increasingly limited. There are a few exceptions, she writes, but it's usually in the professional schools.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Maria.
Yeah, that's a really critical point. I mean, you know, it's we can't stress strongly enough that it's not the people, it's the structural conditions, it's the working conditions, and that's what needs to change. I mean, adjuncts are teaching well not because of the working conditions, but in spite of them.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to think about what are we doing to ourselves by burning out people who really have so much to contribute to the system. And we have to think about it particularly in terms of diversity issues, gender issues, disability issues, because we're shutting out and making it more difficult for a wide variety of people to be involved in teaching.
Well, Adriana, I mentioned in my introduction, how much this is getting much more media attention all of a sudden. Congress is suddenly taking mm-hmm. notice of these conditions and putting out this report. How optimistic are you for real change?
Before I answer that, if it's okay, if I could just jump on to the last caller's question about, I think it alludes to the way that we're degrading the profession of faculty, and really, as we do that long term, it will destroy the quality of higher education. This has really big long term implications, and I don't think that all the people who are involved in making these decisions are connecting it to the various real destructive forces being put in play. But so we now have 70% of the people who are faculty who are no longer allowed to be professionals, to have ongoing professional development, a community that they're a part of, that they can, it's going to be soon that people may not choose to go into the faculty profession. So that's what we're facing as more and more people recognize what the life will be as a faculty member. And do I think there's real change? Yes, I do. I do think that we're coming to some turning points. The large numbers of adjuncts that are now a part of the system, the good organizing efforts of people like the new faculty majority and unions across the campus, across the country, the attention that both Congress and the media have taken. I do see that we're at a tipping point for it'll be hard for institutions not to recognize these very significant changes to both student learning, the profession itself of faculty, and to higher education as an institution.
All right, so Adriana thinks we're at a tipping point. We've got a call from Carol, who's an adjunct at CCSF, and she has a good story to share. Go ahead, Carol, please be brief.
Yeah, basically I wanted to say if we work more than half-time, we do get benefits, and we're strongly encouraged to participate in the Academic Senate. We are strongly encouraged to go to professional development workshops and things. And so I think, I feel overall I've been treated quite well there. However, I think that's one reason why the ACCJC is going after us, because they don't like that we're treated as well as we are.
Well, thank you for that. Jim in Berkeley, we don't have time to get to you, but he says UC Berkeley has 6 different unions and they need to consider organizing fewer but larger unions for more effective bargaining. We just have about 2 minutes left in the show. We've got more sort of sad stories that I can't share with you. But you said, Adriana, that we're at a tipping point. Maria, what's next for this organizing campaign? And for all of you, what advice do you give to your allies in the public? What do you want people to be doing? And we've only got about 30 seconds for each of you. Go ahead, Maria.
Well, we need to keep this momentum going. We need to keep the issue in the public eye. We need to help Congress figure out some practical solutions, perhaps tied to the reauthorization of the Higher Ed Act. And we have to just keep organizing.
And Adriana?
I would just agree with Maria. Those are the main directions forward, and I'm trying to work with other groups like accreditors that look at the quality of higher education, and work with as many stakeholders as possible. And I think to the one caller's point about getting more parents and students involved, that that's really an important effort to continue.
And Christian, what's next in your campaign to organize, and what advice do you have for the public?
Well, I think if you're an adjunct, don't be afraid to organize. Don't be afraid to get involved, to talk about it, to be transparent, actually. I think if you're a tenure or full-time faculty, to lend your support. Your job also, I think, depends a lot on these issues. Also, if you're an administrator, to not be afraid to lend your support. As we said, if you're a parent or you're considering going back to school, do your research about the employment conditions at a school. I think also just to raise as much awareness as possible about this issue is huge right now.
And we'll put links to a lot of information, including all of it, from our guests at yourcallradio.org. You can also continue this conversation there, post resources for the rest of the audience, and put comments there about ideas for solutions or your own experiences. That's yourcallradio.org. I want to thank all of my guests. Christian Nagler is adjunct writing and arts teacher at the San Francisco Arts Institute. Maria Maisto is adjunct English teacher at Cuyahoga Community College in Cleveland, and she's president of the new faculty majority. And Dr. Adriana Kizar is a professor of higher education at the University of Southern California and director of the Delphi Project. We'll again put links to all of that at yourcallradio.org. I want to thank all of you for joining us. Thanks to everybody who called and emailed. I do apologize that we couldn't get to everything. Again, you can post comments, continue this discussion online. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Are we in the midst of the next mass extinction? On the next Your Call with Elizabeth Colbert, author of The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Our planet has already gone through 5 major extinctions, including the one that wiped out the dinosaurs. But this time, humans are the culprit, potentially eradicating 20 to 50% of all living species within this century. How is man-made climate change contributing to the rapid loss of diverse life, and how can we halt it? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Bill Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.